Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first part of the program, we'll be talking, at least in part here to start out, about a decision that was handed down by the United States Supreme Court in April. Now, throughout the term of the court, there are decisions that are seen to have wide-ranging implications, and those get a lot of attention. This was one, perhaps, that didn't get quite so much, but indeed might have some wide-ranging implications of its own. And certainly it was one that was followed by people who work in the area of copyright. And it was a case that we'll talk about here, but basically a lot of people feel that what this decision will mean is that it will be more difficult to get a patent and perhaps also easier to challenge existing patents. We'll be talking a little bit about that, but also try to talk a little bit more broadly about intellectual property and the problems involved in protecting it on the one hand and encouraging innovation on the other. And our guest for the show is John Conklin. He is a partner in the law firm of LVM, that's Ledig, Voigt & Meyer in Chicago, and it's a firm that specializes in dealing with issues like intellectual property law and copyright and so forth. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. He got his law degree from Case Western Reserve University, where he also has an electrical engineering degree as an undergraduate. He has also done work as an electrical engineer. He's been an examiner for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and also a division patent counsel for Motorola. And while he was there, he was responsible for all intellectual property matters involving products such as base stations for mobile radio systems and trunked radio systems. When he was at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, he examined patent applications in the art of motor control systems. And he has a lot of experience in all areas of intellectual property practice. He is talking with us by telephone as we talk. Questions are certainly welcome. I know he'd do his best to answer questions. The number, if you'd like to call in and you're listening here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it might be a long-distance call, if you're listening in and around Indiana where the signal will travel, or perhaps you're even listening on the Internet, you can use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILO or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-WILO. Mr. Conklin, hello.
David, good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
We might talk a little bit first about this particular case. That was the thing that kind of caught my interest, and in part, I think, perhaps because my feeling was, well, I don't really know very much about patents and patent law, and it might be interesting to talk just a little bit about the basics and also about what this decision might well mean.
Sure.
But, and I've read now a number of articles about how this case came about, and I feel a little bit confused. I guess basically what is involved in here is two companies that were making the same kind of a product. This was a product for gas pedals for vehicles.
That's right.
And it involved one way to do that is to use a cable to connect the two for the gas pedal to control the engine.
That's the old way.
That's the old way. The new way is to have an electronic sensor. And here, apparently, we had two companies that had a way of doing this, each of them claiming that they had a patent on this technique, this gas pedal sensor system, and suing the other for copyright infringement. This worked its way up through the courts and eventually came to the Supreme Court. Basically, what was this case about?
Well, the fundamental issue, David, was just regarding the patent held by this actually, I think they were the named defendant, but they were the patent holder, this Teleflex. And they had a patent for a combination of features. It was what you just described, using an electronic sensor to sense the position of the pedal. But then there's also a feature that was out there that people had been using for years where you can adjust the position of the pedal so that if you're a shorter person, for example, I've actually never seen this in a car, but apparently this is old technology. Mm-hmm. You can slide the pedal closer to you so you can, if you have a real deep well, even short people might not be able to get their seat close enough. They can hit that pedal in a safe way. So there's further adjustment that you can get the pedal to come forward to you. So there was a combination of features in the patent that was held by Teleflex that called for moving the pedal forward, so you had an adjustable pedal. And it was also the feature of adjusting the pedal but remaining fixed where the pivot point of the pedal is. I can't describe the detail of that to you because I think to really understand that correctly, I'd have to look at the patents, which I haven't done prior to this call. And then the other feature that was in the patent that Teleflex held was the electronic sensor. So it was a combination of elements. The Supreme Court held that all of those different elements were out there, known in the existing technology for pedals, but nobody had ever put them all together in one single pedal. So the patent office had decided that that was patentable. The district court, when they were fighting about the patentability of that, when the two parties here, KSR and Teleflex, were fighting about it, the district court said it was an obvious combination, that maybe no one had done it before, but all the pieces were out there, and it was just an obvious combination of features of various kinds of pedals. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals that hears all patent infringement cases from the district courts, had said, no, it's not obvious, and the reason it's not obvious is that there was no express, and this is a buzzword, teaching, suggestion, or motivation to combine these separate features that appeared in the technology that was out there before this patent was filed. Then the Supreme Court said, no, that's too rigid an application of this doctrine called teaching, suggestion, or motivation, and reversed the Court of Appeals and upheld the district court's decision that the patent was obvious. It's a major case for patent attorneys and patent law because this doctrine of requiring a teaching, suggestion, or a motivation to combine elements in order to render a patent obvious has been for years taken to be as a requirement, so that if you didn't have that, then patents that were just combinations of known things were patentable. And I think what's happened with the Supreme Court in the last few, maybe three years now, there's been a lot of cases by the Supreme Court that I think is in reaction to the public's, and then somewhat, and you see legislation. Not too much of it has actually made it through Congress, but you see a lot of pending legislation, and it's coming from the public's perception. This is my view anyway, the public's perception that, or at least the business community, their perception that patents are being granted that are too broad, and it's stifling innovation instead of promoting it. Mm.
So just now to make sure that I understand and that people listening understand, Teleflex made this product that was combined these different functions, including the adjustment for the position of the pedal and the sensor system. They said they put all those things together, and they said, well, we have a patent on that. KSR looked at that and said, no, wait a minute. No, we've been doing that. We own at least some parts of this so that you can't patent it. And in fact, it's my understanding that it was always clear, or it has been clear, that you can't take some existing patented device and make a few improvements and change it a little bit and then go out and patent it and sell it yourself. You can't do that unless you go back and you get a license from whoever holds the patent on the original device. So I guess it would seem to me that KSR, if they had a patent on any of the bits that Teleflex put together for their product, that KSR would have had a clear case of infringement on their copyright. And ultimately, I guess they won, although it also seems to me that based on the decision of the court, I'm not sure anybody won.
Well, David, first of all, make sure that don't use copyright, because there's no copyright
I'm sorry.
It's always just, this is just, it was purely a patent case.
I get easily confused because that's another area of intellectual property, and a copyright is a whole different, yeah. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing by statute. So, in fact, there's really three major areas of the law. Just to back off for a minute and get the overview, there's by statute, and it flows out of the Constitution, there's copyrights, there's trademarks, and there's patents. Those are the three big ones. The patents tend to be the ones that are the most complex and can be, and certainly I think recently, get a lot of the press because they seem to attract huge damage awards. If you've seen recently, Microsoft just got hit with the last few months with a $1.5 billion, so the B, judgment. You've probably seen in the press all the back and forth between RIM and a patent holder called NTP, where from day to day you are never sure if you owned a BlackBerry if your email service is going to be shut down because they were being threatened with injunctions. A lot of that publicity in the intellectual property space has been primarily patent in the last few years. Years ago, there was a lot of publicity about copyright law with respect to software. But in any event, what happened here is it's first understand that with patents, an important concept in patents is that you don't have the right when you own a patent to practice the technology. This, a lot of people are surprised by this. So if you own a patent for example, for this gas pedal, whatever it might be, some feature for it, that doesn't mean that you have a right to use it, to manufacture it, and to sell it. It only means that you have a right to exclude others from using it, manufacturing it, or selling it. And it's an important distinction. Mm-hmm. The reason is that someone else, and in this situation, it was if you were KSR, it was Teleflex. Teleflex had a patent that was broader than your patent, so broad that it included your invention. And the reason they could do that is because, I'm not sure this is their facts, but just to keep going with the idea that it's the right to exclude, the reason they can do that, exclude KSR, even though KSR might have a patent on their own pedal, is because they, Teleflex, received their patent earlier in time. So it's an earlier, broader patent. They can exclude you from making your pedal because they say that your pedal is within the scope of a patent that was granted to Teleflex. So even though you hold a patent, you hold it later in time, it's like an improvement over Teleflex's. So your improvement patent is not enough to enable you to manufacture it when you have someone else who says, I've got the basic patent to it. It's kind of like holding a patent to the carburetor. That's Teleflex's patent, and KSR has the patent to a blue carburetor. If you try to manufacture your blue carburetor, it's still a carburetor, and if the earlier guy, in this case it would be Teleflex, had the carburetor patent, you're subject to being sued for patent infringement. So even though both parties can have patents. So that really wasn't the issue here. It was the issue with this case was simply whether a combination of these elements of having a fixed pivot point adjustable pedal and a electronic sensor to sense the position of the pedal, those three elements all in one device in the patent, in Teleflex's patent, was patentable over technology that came before Teleflex's patent, which didn't have all three things in one device, but had two of the three in one technology and one somebody else's patent that came earlier. And another, the third feature, in yet another patent, and whether it would be obvious to combine all three of those features into one device, which is what the Teleflex patent showed. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, it's obvious. There's just nothing beyond ordinary creativity that went into combining all three features into one device, even though nobody had put all three features in one device before.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds as if then Teleflex, on the one hand, their gamble was if they were successful in this lawsuit, that it would mean that nobody else could manufacture that product unless they said so and got some money. So they lost that, although it also, it sounds to me like now, as a result of this case, of losing the case, Teleflex could still make the product, but now it sounds like anybody could make it. Anybody could take that, that same, put together those same features and make their own competing product, and Teleflex couldn't do anything about it.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, the big thing about this case, though, David, that has the attention of at least the patent community, the intellectual property community, is that it weakens the strength of patents when you litigate them. They are now more susceptible to being attacked. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, because there was the part of the analysis to whether a patent is obvious, and this goes both when it's examined as a patent application in the patent office and when it's challenged in litigation in the district courts, in the federal court system. What it used to be is that in order for this situation to this situation of technology where you had two of the three features had been practiced in the prior technology and the third feature was known but had never been linked up to the other two before, prior to this case, you would have had, if you wanted to challenge the patent, you would have had to show that there was actually some problem that was being solved or some suggestion in the art, something that you would be able to point to in the prior literature that came before the patent that would suggest adding that third element to the combination and getting the three things that the Teleflex patent had in it. The court's saying, no, that's too rigid. You don't have to show that because that's a requirement that goes beyond the existing law that we've set down, we, the Supreme Court, have set down before. And they basically spanked, David, they spanked the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, for saying that you're coming up with two rigid rules for analyzing the obviousness of technology that's defined in patents, and you need to back off. This is a rule that you came up with, Court of Appeals. We don't agree with it. And, in fact, we think it's inconsistent with our last time that we, the Supreme Court, opined on what's the proper analysis to determine whether a patent is obvious or unobvious.
So you believe, as some people say, that as a result of this decision by the Supreme Court, that it will in the future make it more difficult to get a patent, and it will also make it easier to challenge existing patents?
No question about it. I think the everyone will have different opinions, but I think ultimately no one's going to can tell you for sure how much of an effect it will have. It may be just incremental, and for the majority of us, the public, it's not anything that anyone's going to lose sleep over. For us in the business, patent attorneys, IP specialists, it may be more important to us on a day-to-day basis. It's hard to know where it's going to land, but it definitely will have an effect and makes it easier to challenge the validity of patents, both in the patent office when they're being examined as patent applications and after they're issued and being challenged in federal court, no question.
It seemed that part of the thinking of the court, the Supreme Court, was that too many patents had been granted. Do you think that that's the case, or is it even possible to say such a thing, that there were too many patents?
My personal experience is that it was too easy to get a patent, and too easy. I would say this, that in the patent office, the effect is a little bit less noticeable than it is in the federal courts, but with the doctrine that was in place, and this teaching, suggestion, motivation doctrine that you had to have in order to combine prior art elements in order to invalidate a patent claim, that made it very difficult to challenge a patent if in federal court, especially if the technology was complex. Just for example, biotechnology, computer software technology, anything that had some level of complexity to it to someone that's not versed in that technology, it became, I think for most of us lawyers, if we were representing clients and we're trying to challenge a patent in federal court, we became very, very reluctant to advise our client that you wanted to defend against an accusation of infringement by saying the patent was invalid because it was obvious, because it was just a variation over what came before, the technology that came before. It was not necessarily a favored defense because of this requirement now that's been struck down.
It just—it seems to me that it must be that, or that it might be a difficult matter for whoever it is that decides whether a patent should be granted, whether something is indeed. It might be clear in some cases that something, someone has invented something that just didn't exist before, something totally, completely new, but. It seems like it's a much more difficult situation when you get into whether you say, well, okay, this is a useful device and that there are some features about it that are new. But then you get into this question of, well, is this something that not anybody on the street, but perhaps anybody who works in this field would have thought of? You get together all the electrical engineers. Is it really a case that only one out of a thousand of these engineers would have come up with this idea, or would most of them look at it and say, well, yeah, that's not all that innovative. I could imagine that happening. It seems that's a very difficult sort of question to resolve, and that most cases are not inventions that are completely out of the blue, staggeringly new idea.
Exactly, David. And I think in fairness to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, they developed this test that the Supreme Court said, no, this is too rigid, and you're applying it every time and making it a requirement and a prerequisite and an integral part of an analysis that you do in determining whether a challenge patent is obvious. But the court went that way because what you're talking about is that if you make it less rigorous, then it becomes almost too general and subject to the subjective viewpoint, and then you get unfair results. Ultimately, you get your result depends on who's making the decision, instead of and that might always be the case, but instead of being more rigorous and requiring very specific factual findings all along the way. But the court acknowledged that, and the Supreme Court did in this decision. It understands why the Court of Appeals went the direction they did. But they're just saying that that we understand it, but you've gone too far. You need to back off. This test that you've been applying and making a requirement, we're not saying that it's a bad test, but your requirement that it be satisfied every single time a patent is challenged to be obvious is bad.
Let me just take a moment here to introduce again our guest. We're already at the midpoint of this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with John Conklin. He's an attorney in the law firm of Lady Voigt and Meyer in Chicago, where they specialize in dealing with things like intellectual property law and copyright. In addition to being an attorney, he also has an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering and has worked as an electrical engineer. He's also been an examiner for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and a division patent counsel for Motorola. We're talking a little bit this morning here about intellectual property. We started out talking about this particular case that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court just a couple of months ago, and what that would mean for patents and for people who work in the patent field. Perhaps also we'll talk here in a little bit more general way about intellectual property. Questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you talked a little bit earlier. I misused the term copyright. And you rightly corrected me. And I think that is, people get confused about these categories, these devices that are constructed to, the idea is here, if someone develops something that could be an invention, they could be writing a book, it could be composing a piece of music, it could be, if you develop a trademark, some kind of very distinctive thing that you can use for your business to to set it apart from other businesses, those things, copyright, patents, trademarks. The idea is that people who come up with those things should be entitled to profit from them for some period of time before they come into the public domain.
That's exactly right. And it's an important, more important, I think, ever now than it ever was, David, simply because of the way our economy is now based and continues to evolve to less manufacturing base, to more of a service-based economy, and more intellectual property-based because it's service-based. If anyone out there has seen some of the statistics that are issued by our government, the federal government, intellectual property is valued very highly in our GNP and seems to be growing as a way of evaluating the wealth of the nation. It's an important topic, and something that it's important for, I think, all of us to understand for our future.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also seems to be that with an increasingly kind of globalized economy, and as we move into a digital age where information can be encoded and traded and transported, that it becomes increasingly the business of protecting intellectual property becomes increasingly challenging.
Becomes increasingly challenging, I think, and something that should be considered by just the average person to be less something that's out there, has nothing to do with me, because of the way our economy has evolved. If you think about it, if you had a factory, it's protecting your factory and preventing others from using your factory, it's easy. Obviously, somebody can't just walk in and start using your factory, or at least they can't do it very easily. But when you have an idea and you're making money off of trading on your service that has that idea integrated into it, whether you're selling your services as a programmer with some particular programming techniques that you'd like no one else to be using, particularly, obviously, your direct competition, well, that's harder to protect because once it's out there, it floats all around. You can use it, but somebody else can be using it at the same time because it doesn't just exist as a thing. It's an idea. Two people, three people, a million people could all be using it simultaneously, whereas your factory, you're using it. You can't have a million other people using it as a practical matter. It's just a different way of thinking about what property is. But intellectual property is property in the same sense. You can protect it in the same way that you can protect real property. The factories are going away. We have more and more of our wealth is based on our skills, our education, our ability to do things and innovate and provide new ideas, and less on just being able to manufacture something. And it's that point, I think, that's important for people to understand, is that we need to not only have strong intellectual property laws here in the United States, but it's important for our federal government to encourage foreign governments to have strong intellectual property laws.
It was my understanding, at least as far as patents are concerned, is that patents are territorial, and that you're granted a patent for your invention in the United States, but that's not going to extend to another country unless that country says we will honor that patent. Is with all intellectual property, is that essentially the same case?
Yes, and it's because all of the intellectual property flows out of the laws of your own country. Patents, copyrights, trademarks, all are based on statutory law, and in turn, the statutes are fundamentally based on the U.S. Constitution. So if you go over to China, say, for example, which is the one that everyone talks about as being the notorious copier, they have copyright, trademark, patent laws over there. It's strictly now the question of those laws evolving, because they are relatively simple laws. They haven't been in force for, I think, more than maybe the last 20 years, maybe 25 years. But a good part of those 25 years, they were just shells. There wasn't much going on in enforcing them. But in China now, you're seeing more and more respect given to intellectual property, and I think in part it's just self-serving on China's part, as some of those factories that have found their way over to China are starting themselves to have engineers that are working as part of those companies that run those factories, and they're coming up with their own innovations. So they're the government, Chinese government, is becoming more and more proactive in protecting intellectual property, and also in response to a lot of pressure coming from other countries like the United States. So each country, yes, has its own intellectual property laws.
Mm-hmm. And then, so if you know, for example, if you have the case where you have somebody in China, somewhere in China, turning out millions of pirated copies of Pirates of the Caribbean, and you want them to stop that, then how do you, here, if you're here in the United States, if you're whatever studio that is that owns that movie, what do you do to go after, to try to, I suppose you want to put pressure on the government of China for them actually to make sure that they go after people who are doing that there in China?
That's the most difficult one right now, David, that's more copyright issue than patent. Mm-hmm. But what happens with those situations is there is a mechanism in China, but there's a real problem with enforcing it, simply because the mechanism is there, but the enforcement, when it comes down to the practical level of just getting a hold of the copies and finding a person that is the distributor and where the warehouse is a game of cat and mouse. You can find out where these folks are at, but as soon as you turn the wheels of the bureaucracy there in China to get to them and to seize those goods, those folks will pack up and change the name of their company, move down the street, literally, open up at a new address with a new name, and keep selling the copies of Pirates of the Caribbean. And then you'll find out that they moved down the street through some more investigation, and you'll go after them. And what happens is that when you turn those wheels in the Chinese government system, the problem is that as soon as those wheels are there, there's a lack of integrity, at least at that level, at least right now there is, and there's going to be somewhere along the path of those various wheels that you're starting to turn to get enforcement, somebody's going to tell that that person that's running, those business people that are running that warehouse and selling the illegally copied videos, that they're about to be seized and you need to get out of there. That happens, unfortunately, I think more often than you would catch them. So it's a continuous problem on the copyright side. Patents less so, simply because things that are associated with patents, there's usually a factory. It's hard just to pick up the factory and leave, although there's certainly situations of that as well. But that's more difficult to stay one step ahead of the enforcement.
Yeah, I suppose the thing about the technology of burning a DVD is not particularly sophisticated now, so that it wouldn't be a difficult thing at all to set up a shop to make Pirates of the Caribbean if that's what you're going to do. But I'm sure if it was a more complicated sort of thing that you were manufacturing, then the infrastructure you would need to do that manufacturing would be more complicated, and then the whole business of setting up shop and then moving if you had to would also be more complicated.
Right.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Very interesting. Copyright law, intellectual property law, period, such an arcane subject to me. But my first preliminary question is, what is the current congressional mandate or length prescribed for the length of a patent? Does Congress regulate the length of a patent?
Yes, it does. It's by statute. It's 20 years from the filing date.
Okay. Now, this is going to lead me into a question that deals with a peculiar area of interest of mine, and that is the cost and affordability of prescription drugs and the problem that involves in terms of patented brand names and moving from that to, when the patent expires, generics, which are generally less costly to the consumer. And my question to you, and this is a question that many have asked, whether manufacturers of drugs, pharmaceutical manufacturers of drugs, have become adept at using the concept of patent to protect the brand name in very clever ways, such that they squeeze out the availability of generics. and thus adversely affect the affordability or availability of cheaper generic drugs. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Sure. Very, very hot topic. I think, in fact, there is a blanking on the country right now, but there is one country that is refusing to enforce patents in the pharmaceutical area because they want to get, I think it might be an African country, I'm not sure now, but they decided that the drug companies were not getting the drugs to their citizens in a way that was affordable. So they needed to strip away the IP protection for the in best interest of their citizens. The drug companies will tell you that they need the IP, the patent protection, in order to make the profits that they need to plow back into the next generation products because it's so expensive to develop these drugs. But I think some of the things that you're talking about as well. Now I'm not a I don't have the background. I don't work in the pharmaceutical area. I don't have those kind of clients that I work with, but others in my firm do. So I'm aware of some of the practices that I hear that are accused of the pharmaceutical companies, or they're accused of conducting a pattern of extending their patent protection by issuing patents to a basic, say, drug that turns out to be a very popular one, so they get the 20 years. But then also that they see that, and you'll know fairly soon in that 20-year time period whether it's popular or not, they will then come up with enhancements to it that are more marketing-driven than driven by the effectiveness of the drug and extend their profitability by selling the enhanced version of that drug under a second patent now that's got another 20 years to it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And keep on going and going. I've heard of that criticism. I can't speak to it simply because I don't practice in that area, but I can understand it, and I can see that that can happen. You can get improvements, and as those improvements come to the pharmaceutical company, they will patent it. Now, whether they're motivated by we'll just market the improvement, it's not really that much better than the. Than some other version, or maybe even the base pharmaceutical formula that we had 20 years ago. So it's really marketing driven. I can't tell you that. I don't know.
Okay, but that is a hot issue. I understand.
Very hot issue.
All right, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We're talking this morning with John Conklin. He is an attorney in the Chicago firm of Leydig, Voigt & Meyer. They specialize in things like copyright and intellectual property. In addition to having a law degree from Case Western Reserve, he also has an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering, also from Case. He's worked as an electrical engineer. He's also been an examiner for the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and also Division Patent Counsel for Motorola. And we're talking a bit this morning about, started out talking about patents, also talking more broadly about intellectual property. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As far as patents are concerned, has 20 years always been the standard time for a patent to run?
No, it was. It used to be, David. It was 17 years from the time they issued. But what happened? It was a change. It's been a while now. Maybe it's been over 10 years ago. I've lost track of the exact time. But it was changed simply because some people abused it by keeping applications pending for many, many years, and they would. Keep churning the patent protection in the applications while technology evolved and would write claims or write their patent application, rewrite their patent application to cover technology as it evolved because this gets into what goes into a patent application, but they had the ability to do that. And they could have a patent application filed in 1960 and wouldn't issue until from the patent office until 1970, in part because of the applicant himself or herself maintaining it in an application. And not issuing until 1970, and then it would be 17 years from 1970. The law was changed to prevent that kind of manipulation so that it was 20 years from the filing date.
Hmm. So that was actually, in effect, it was a way to get more than 20 years.
It was a way to extend your protection, and typically people were doing that filed for inventions that were very, I'm going to call them pioneering, but they were very non-commercial. They would see a way of making something, say that somebody could figure out how to make color TVs back in, probably this is not maybe a good example, but if you figured out how to make color TV in 1930, but you knew that the way of making this color TV was going to cost $10,000, even in 1930 dollars, and it was totally impractical, and you would never sell it to anybody. And if you did sell it to someone, it would only work for about 10 hours, and then it would blow up. The patent office, because of the way the statute reads, doesn't prevent you from patenting that. There's nothing about in the laws of whether something is patentable or not as to how much it costs or how reliable it is. It could be very unreliable. It can't be dangerous, but it could fail. It can just stop working after maybe 10 hours. And nobody's going to pay $10,000, period, even if it worked a long time. But you certainly wouldn't pay $10,000 for a color TV back in 1930 if it only worked for 10 hours. And the other thing is nobody's going to pay for a color TV unless somebody's broadcasting the color, all those kind of things. But if you wanted to patent it because you knew the basic technology and you could see 20 years down the line in 1950 or 1960, whenever it came in, 30 years later, that the technology was going to improve and that the cost would come down because manufacturing techniques would improve, then what you would do is you say, well, I don't want to issue this patent right away because even if I issued right away 17 years from now, I'm still not going to make any money off of it, but I'll just keep it floating around in the patent office literally until 1960, and then I'll get serious about it. And then when it issues, I'll have 17 years, and I'll have all these folks that are making color TVs, and I'll sue them all. And there was variations of that happened. That's what caused the change in the patent laws. There's been continual tweaking of the patent laws over the years. And particularly in the last 10 years, we've had a lot of amendments to the laws. And there's a lot of legislation pending right now. IP gets a lot of attention. I'd say particularly in the last 5-10 years, it's getting more and more.
Yeah. Well, I'm also thinking about what happened admittedly, here again, we're going over into copyright, but happened relatively recently with the extension of the right. And this was a case that did actually get some attention, and I believe that it was Walt Disney who brought the case because their copyright on Mickey Mouse was going to expire,
uh-huh.
and they wanted to continue to have exclusive rights to make Mickey Mouse stuff,
right.
And they managed to get it extended. And I think there was a lot of complaint that was... You know, that the idea is that, yes, in fact, that someone who develops something, whether it's an idea, it's an invention, whatever it is, should be able to profit for that for a reasonable length of time. And then eventually, though, at some point, someday, it's supposed to be able to pass into the public domain,
right.
And the idea here was that they found a way to squeeze a little bit more out of it, keep their exclusive control longer. And that just somehow goes contrary to the idea of balancing balancing the right of the developer to profit, but the eventual right of the public to have that thing. Is that something where a kind of a tension that you see continuing between the people who one way or another want to continue to have exclusive rights to their inventions or whatever it is, and other people who say, no, there ought to be some point where that simply just runs out?
Well, that's why I also think that for many of your listeners, this should not be an esoteric backwater of archaic law. Mm-hmm. It always has been. But things like that, your example, is a good example of policies that we should be paying more attention, particularly now as intellectual property becomes a more and more important part of our national wealth. It's all legislative driven. The Constitution sets out very broad. These are one or two liners in our Constitution. So the terms of copyrights, the terms of patents, exactly who can get copyrights or patents or trademarks and how they get them is all controlled by our Congress. So if you've got someone that has a lot of influence or is gets a lot of attention because they're deemed to be an important part of the economy, they can drive legislation. So it's important for us to pay attention to that rather than react to it after the fact. We should have, I think, more debate at the national level about intellectual property. I'm not optimistic that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Simply because it's just not a very interesting topic. But unfortunately, I think it's an important one that's not interesting, and that's usually a bad combination.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
Good subject because I own an advertising business years ago, and I sold it about 5 years ago, but I used to own a lot of copyrights and actually sued people once who violated it, and that's a rather expensive proposition. But I wanted to ask you, I don't know if you, I came into this late, so I'm not sure. Did you talk about the recent circuit court ruling on patents and the obvious nature of a patent? And what is obvious? You know, like the patent, you know, the patent law is pretty simple. It says something that is not obvious to the general, you know, the general public. I read the ruling. I downloaded it from the web. And it's a little arcane, the knowledge and language. But I'm wondering what you think about that or if you've talked about that or not.
We actually did talk about that for about the first half of the show, that's okay. If we have a couple of minutes here. John, you want to go back and try to recap that, certainly can.
I think it's a real important ruling because, like all law, when I did go to court, I did the thing for a company. They backed me, but I still had to put my own money, part of my money into this. But, the arcane nature of the language of law and copyright law and trademark law and all this stuff, and you're sitting there and all these, these people are just, I think copyright law is almost moot now with the internet. I mean, I don't see why anybody even mentions it anymore because unless you're like Disney and you've got billions of dollars to go after people, people steal stuff all the time, so what's the point? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'll take your answer off the air.
Please. Okay.
Well, let me say one thing, David, about what the caller just said about how much expense and time he spent to one of the things, and it's not peculiar to copyright or patent or trademark or IP in general, is the nature of our legal system. We have something called a discovery process, which ends up at the end of the day being very expensive for litigants, where you go through a process of requesting information from your opponent, from the other side. And it chews up a lot of time in the federal courts, state courts as well. But we've got a system that is more extensive with respect to the requirements of giving information to the other side than I think virtually anywhere else in the world. And it's expensive. I mean, it's beyond probably the scope of this conversation, whether it's good or bad. But a lot of the expense that he's talking about flows out of that. And it's enhanced by the complexity also of the subject matter when you get into patent litigation. Patent litigation is very expensive by a combination of those factors, the technology, the law itself, and then you've got all that discovery on top of it. What he was talking about, though, was that Supreme Court case, the KSR versus Teleflex that we started out talking about. And that that case, he's right, it has made a fundamental change, but to opine on, for anybody, whether you have me or anyone on the line, you might have some people that have got very strong opinions, but I think fundamentally the truth is that nobody knows how this decision is going to play out in the patent office, in the district courts, other than to say for sure is that it will make it easier. It has made it easier to challenge patents.
Just as a way of finishing up, and unfortunately we have about a minute, the Congress has been for some time trying to reform the patent system, and we have another attempt now going. It's called the 2007 Patent Reform Act.
Yes.
And this one, though, apparently people think actually might have a chance of passage. Is there something about this that you think is particularly important? Would it make a positive change?
Well, one of the things that is in the legislation, at least the last time I looked, I don't know if it's been marked up or what the status is, because this was, I think, introduced in the last Congress, has been introduced again. So I believe it's the same piece of legislation, maybe with some minor changes, but basically the same piece that was introduced last Congress. But there's one piece in it that I'm particularly interested in, which I hope survives, which is some additional statutory change that I'm hoping will, it doesn't say absolutely, but it goes to damage awards. There's been huge damage awards in the recent years that I think have also gotten a lot of complaints as to whether they are justified or not. And there's some language in this bill that I'm hoping would act with, would give the impetus to the district courts to cut back on some of these awards. Some of them are really getting to be very, very high and subject to a lot of criticism.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've here come to the end of the time. We just want to say thanks to our guest, John Conklin. He's a partner in the Chicago firm Ladig, Void & Meyer, dealing with intellectual property law and copyrights and so forth. Mr. Conklin, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
David, thanks for having me.